7. Donations can be made anytime at WPFW.org or by calling 800-222-9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
Put the finger roll! What's the foul?
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Peace, 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 and welcome to The Collision with Sports and Politics Collide. I'm Matan Thomas. Dave Zirin and Chuck Modiano are both out today, so I have a special guest co-host. He played at Syracuse University, from 2005 to 2009. He averaged 15.7 points per game in his final season at Syracuse. He ranks 14th on the school's all-time scoring list, with 1,680 points. Currently a college basketball analyst and an all-around great guy, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Eric Diebendorf. How you doing, sir?
I appreciate you having me on, man. It's an honor and it's a pleasure, man.
Oh, no. It's great. It's great. You know, there's so much that I want to jump into and talk with you about. But first, before we get into all that, I want you to talk about all of the things that you're doing around Syracuse with your foundations and your charity works, because it's really important and it's really special. So just to tell all the people all the stuff that you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, first off, I've just been blessed, man, to have a platform, that Syracuse basketball gave me. So all the things that I do, I'm able to kind of get it out there and people gravitate towards it. And it all started, obviously, with Syracuse basketball. So I'm super blessed and super grateful for that and for Syracuse University. But we've been doing a lot, man. You know, you mentioned the college basketball, analyst stuff. That's been awesome. I've been doing that for the past 2 years, really getting my feet wet with that. I do Boston College the end of the month, and I go to Florida State, and I have Syracuse at Louisville in January. So that's been great. But besides that, I had my ED23 Foundation that I've launched almost a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So before the foundation, we've doing a lot of stuff in the community, man, whether it's back-to-school events, turkey dinner giveaways. And we do shoe, hat, coat drives, glove giveaways, all that stuff. We've been doing it for a while. But the past year and a half, I established the ED23 Foundation just to try to impact the community on a larger level. And, when you have that, the foundation, you're just able to do a little bit more, get a little bit more money in towards the events and, in return, just impact more people. So recently, this past Thanksgiving, we gave out 600 turkey dinners, on the south side of Syracuse. This is the seventh year we've did it. The first year We did it in the back of the Salvation Army with like four people. It was just me and my guy, Todd Roosh, who kind of came up with the idea, and we handed out 100 turkeys. So it was just 100 turkeys in that first year. And then, you know, coming into our seventh year, it's not only turkeys, but it's turkey dinners, you know, with all the fixings and the sides. And we were able to hand out almost 600 of those this year. So the growth has been amazing. You know, shout out to the Syracuse community who has always backed me. You know, every time we put something out, you know, how can I help? You know, can I volunteer? You know, where do you need me to drop this off at? So, you know, I'm just lucky to be able to have a platform. Like I said, I put the stuff out there and then the community really comes around it, man, and just makes it happen. You can't do it by yourself. Have a great board through the foundation and then, you know, just a great community to support everything that we're doing. So we're going to continue to do it. We're actually getting a women's empowerment event together. That will be at the end of March, I believe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of women on our board, on my board, and a lot of women who help out. And obviously, you know, my mom and my sister, and I have two daughters, my girlfriend Jacqueline. So they mean the world to me. So I want to be able to do something for the women and just shine a light on them and give them the recognition that they deserve. So we're just going to keep doing it. We're going to keep trying to give back, keep trying to be service to others. For me, that's the ultimate success. You know, I've been through a lot of ups and downs, a lot of trials and tribulations. And what I really found out is helping other people, being of service to others is the best feeling that I've ever had in my life. So just want to continue to do that.
That's great. That's great. And you're someone who is not, you know, afraid to tell your personal story. You know, I've heard you speaking to young people before and you kind of share your personal stories. You mentioned that some of your ups and downs with them as a form of motivation. Talk about how you felt comfortable to start doing that, because a lot of people don't like to do it.
Well, anytime you want to grow as a person and you want to see growth, you have to get outside of yourself, right? You have to get outside of your comfort zone, you know, whether it be, you know, through sport. You know, you're going to do drills that you've never done before. I tell the kids all the time that I work with, look, it's not going to be perfect. You're going to feel awkward. You're going to make mistakes, but it's about reps. It's about doing it over and over and over again. And I think, you know, the same thing when we're speaking about ourselves and our mistakes, it's, you know, the more you talk about it, the more you get it off your chest, the more you're comfortable doing it. And what it really does is, look, everybody goes through these things, right? It's not like, I think sometimes we kind of like, hey, it's just, I'm the only one in the world going through this or making mistakes or whatever it may be. Everyone is having these thoughts. Everyone is making mistakes. Everybody's going through these challenges and these trials. And the more you speak on it, I think it brings, you know, human beings, regardless of race, age, you know, gender, it brings us together because we all have that commonality, right? We all are going to make mistakes. You know, we're all going to go through challenges. And when you speak on it, it just, I've learned that it brings us together even more, you know. So besides helping me, I'm helping other people, you know, just, you know, get outside of their selves and, you know, speak on their problems and their issues. And when you do that, you kind of, you let go of it, you know what I'm saying? And that's what you have to do to be able to get past things. Like, yes, it happened. I made a mistake. Like, I can't keep holding on to that mistake, because what it's doing is not letting me grow into who I can really become. You know, the person that I'm really meant to be, the person that God has, you know, made us into what we're supposed to be. You can't become that if you're holding on to all these past transgressions and everything that, you know, you made a mistake on or whatever it may be. So when you talk about it, it lets go a little bit more and more each time. And is it easy? No. But is it worth it? Absolutely, man. So I think the big thing for me is when I talk about it, it helps other people. And we just talked about, you know, being of service to others. That's the ultimate success. And there's so many different forms you could do it in, whether it's, you know, doing the turkey drives, the back to school events, whether it's talking on the radio about, you know, certain topics, whether it's going to speak in front of people. It's so many different forms of help, of how you could help people. And, you know, I want to try to be able to, I guess, be good at all of those, you know, whether it's talking about it, whether it's doing it, putting hands and feet on the ground. And again, I'm learning as I go, you know. It's like, how can I get better? How can I speak better? How could I, you know, be transparent to these people who need help or want help or whoever that may be. So it's a lifelong journey, man, but it's worth it. And man, it's been so rewarding. And again, it's not, it's not about me. It's about helping other people. You know, I think a lot of times people kind of get it messed up that they want to do stuff, you know, give back whatever to thinking they're getting it back in return. They're going to get something back from that. Something's good going to happen to them. That's not what it's about. You know, you're doing it because it's the right thing to do. You want to help people, and in return, it's just going to help the world be a better place.
Right. That's great. Well, like I say, much respect to you for that and everything you're doing. Just tell the people one more time how they can get in touch with you, your social medias and your foundation and your website, just everything, so I don't forget about that.
Yeah, so social media, Instagram, Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. It's just Eric Diefendorf. But the Twitter and Instagram is at ED23Hoops, and then my foundation is at ED23Foundation. The website is ED23Foundation.org. And then the for-profit, the Hoop side, where I do camps and clinics and workouts and things like that, it's ED23Hoops.com. And a lot of times the foundation helps the Hoop side. The kids who can't afford the camps and the clinics, the foundation will provide scholarships to those kids. We just had a camp not too long ago with Donnie Freeman and Eddie Lampkin. I think we gave away like 35 scholarships, and there was, you know, probably 60 kids at the camp. So over half the kids were paid for through the foundation. So we're just going to continue to try to help kids out, continue to try to give the resources and provide the opportunities to help these kids going forward.
That's great. Well, let me jump into the first question for you. You know, you mentioned that you're a college analyst now, and let me just ask you, how different is the game of basketball right now than what you know played, what I played, you know, what we grew up playing? How different is it right now?
For me, totally different. I now with the NIL and the landscape, it's so many things that you have to navigate through. Not only, you know, the coaches and the adults, but the players. I mean, there's so many different things coming at them. And with social media too, we had social media, or I had social media going into it, but it was kind of just, I guess, blossoming into what it was going to become. So it wasn't as much of a distraction as it is now. Now it's everywhere. You know, you're looking on your phone before the game, after the game, you know, hopefully not during the game at halftime, but it's just so many distractions for these guys. It's hard for them to really navigate, lock in, and what's the purpose? The purpose is to play basketball, you know, and to improve your game. But again, there's so many different opportunities now to make money. You don't even have to go pro. You don't have to go pro anymore. You got these guys getting paid, you know, $500,000 to $1 million, some more. They're really set for life if they take care of what they're supposed to take care of now, you know, invest their money or whatever it may be. They don't even have to go pro. You know, so in my head, I'm thinking, well, where's the motivation at? You know, for me, it was like since I was 7 years old, the motivation was to be in the NBA. You know, every single day I was waking up before school, playing basketball, during lunch, after school. I don't see the love anymore like that and the passion for the game. I kind of see the love. They love what comes with it. You know, the accolades and the, you know, the Instagram highlights or you know, the endorsements, the sponsorships, they love that. And you know, rightfully so, you want to be recognized for what you do. But at the end of the day, I feel like college basketball has lost the pureness of it. You know, like the love of the game. It's just the rivalries. You know, we're talking about Syracuse versus Stanford now. Like, Syracuse versus California. Like, those aren't, you know, we never played those teams. And of course, it's a money thing, and the ACC has to do what it has to do to make money. But at the end of the day, you're losing those, the pureness of college basketball, the love of college basketball. And you could see it in the attendance, in the crowd. I mean, this is, you know, I guess speaking from a Syracuse point of view, it's probably the lowest attendance the Dome has had in over 25 years. You know, it's just, and I think that plays a lot into the NIL space and these fans not really recognizing these guys anymore. You know, when you were playing, you know, guys were going to be there for 2, 3, 4 years, you know, and, you know, the average fan, they knew who they're going to cheer for. They had their favorite player. Nowadays, this guy might leave tomorrow. You know, if he's upset, he might go jump ship and you know, transfer somewhere else. So it's like it's a new team every single year. I think it's hard for the fans. I think it's it's kind of watered down college basketball a little bit. And don't get me wrong, the talent and the skill level is there. I mean, nowadays, I think it's more skill and talent than we ever saw, you know, from, you know, a physical standpoint and just what players can do. But is the effort, is the heart there, is the love for the game there? I just don't see it as much, and I think it waters the game down. Now,
interesting. Let me jump in because I have a little bit of a different perspective. You know, I've gone through and I've written about and talked about a long time about what I felt was the exploitation of the NCAA with college athletes, where decades, you know, you see how much. I remember me and Jay Hart, you know, our freshman year up in the coaches, you know, offices, going through stuff we weren't supposed to be going through, and looking at how much the team made the year before. Now, the year before was John Wallace, you know, accusing the house, you know, all the way to the championship game. And we looked at the numbers and the millions. I was like, wow, I didn't know it was this much. Like, they're really making a lot of money. And yeah. I remember before that in high school reading the Fab Five book and how fun it was for them their freshman year and how great they were having, time they were having, and it was, you know, a blast. And then their sophomore year they came, and then they started seeing their jerseys being sold and their, you know, with their number on it and the video games and all the different stuff. And I think Chris Webber told the story of how he didn't have enough, you know, money to take a girl out on a date. And so I started looking at the exploitation of NCAA from that point on. And as I kept looking at it, you know, when you see the different things, of course, we, you know, everybody in Syracuse knows Derek Coleman's been very vocal about, you know, that as well. See how much the school has been making historically off of players and the players not getting anything in return except for the scholarship. But then I remember being in economics class in Syracuse and looking at just pure numbers, and the numbers didn't match. Now, back in the 40s, you know, 50s, it's a good trade-off. You know, you get a scholarship, you play, but then once you enter in TV contracts and merchandise and you have basketball-related income and how those different things play into the bottom line, it's a form of exploitation. So I kind of have always been on the side that, you know, college athletes should be getting paid for what they're doing, because it's kind of like a minor league in every way that or a professional league in every way except for the athletes don't get paid. Everybody at every level that has anything to do with the basketball team or the football team or anybody else is on a salary but the players. So I looked at it a little bit differently, but I do understand what you're saying as far as now, since players are coming into college already make, like you said, they can make they don't have to go to the league. They can make, you know, a very good money. It is a difference. But I don't, you know, it's a kind of a long time coming, you know, to be honest, but I see the difference in probably the mentality, because the struggle isn't there that we went to school with. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, it can work both ways.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I'm not against NIL at all. I'm 100% with the that think the players should get paid, because like you said, we're the product on the court or on the field or whatever it is. We're the ones that the fans are paying to see. Our jerseys are getting sold in stores. I remember, you know, riding the bus down in New York City one year at the Big East tournament, and my jersey's in the Nike store in the middle of Manhattan, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't see any of that. You know, I'm trying to get $20 to get my haircut. You know, I remember going to Bernie Fine asking for $20 to get my haircut, and that's like an issue back in the day. You know, like they're trying to be secretive about that. So I'm all for players getting paid. I just think that there's not really any accountability right now on either side. There has to be contracts. If you're getting paid, there has to be contracts. Like it can't be where these players can just up and leave, you know, after a year. It's hurting the programs. It's, you know, and it's obviously if you're Texas or if you're Ohio State, you have the money already, like in the NIL account. It doesn't really matter. But I think it has to be, you know, 2 to 3 year contracts or whatever it may be. But then it has to be accountability on the school side, because right now the school is not even involved in the NIL, just to be honest. Like they're all outside sources.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, the thing about this, and I have to, you know, have a different, you know, perspective of that as well. Like, you know, it's so before when they had the one and dones, guys were coming and leaving, And, you know, you have programs like Kentucky, Memphis, everything like that, just full of one and dones. And that was expected. And it didn't hurt the product as far as attendance and, you know, fans and everything like that. So they didn't have a connection with, you know, people like say you said at Syracuse, where you had guys stay 2, 3, 4 years. You know, we both were 4-year guys, but it worked just fine with other programs that was just filled with one and done. So I think it can't happen. It's just an adjustment period right now of what people are used to. But as far as the motivation, you know, the tough part of that is like, it's a business. And, you know, I always took the position that, well, if a coach can leave with no reason, you know, not finish their contract, that coach is the one that recruited you, that sat there in your living room with your family and told them how committed that they are to you and committed to your family. And, you know, they pledged this to make sure that you graduate and all the stuff the coaches say. And then the next year they get a better contract, so they leave, because that's the name of the game. That's how it happens. But yeah, if the coaches are having that freedom to be able to do that, why shouldn't the players have that same freedom?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think you're 100% right. I just think it has to be something done to where it doesn't feel like it's the wild, wild west. You know, like you were talking about the quarterback at UNLV. You know, they paid him $100,000, $150,000, and he didn't even play a game. He just left. You know, and it has to be accountability on both sides, like for the coaches as well. Like it has to be stipulations in the contract to where, hey, if you do get a better job or whatever, you have to give this amount of money back, or, you know, this amount of scholarship, whatever it is. I'm all for, like, you know, players having that freedom. I mean, shoot, I just missed out. You know, I was late to the ball. Man, I wish we both were, man.
We both did. We both did.
Yeah,
you know, are you surprised at the numbers that they're so now, you know, for everybody that doesn't know, the number one prospect in high school basketball, AJ DeBunsta, he committed to BYU. Now, you could have given me 100 guesses and I wouldn't have thought that he would have picked BYU. But the numbers that he is getting as an incoming, you know, freshman is, you know, it's setting a bar that nobody really thought that it would be this way. And you've heard different numbers, you know, thrown out there. I mean, some people say 5 million. So 5 to 7 million is what he's getting. Do you see that as an issue? Because a lot of people were very shocked and surprised at that number. But my position is always that if they can come up with that money, that means they have it. You know what I mean? It's hard for me to feel sorry for the universities when so many years of exploitation has happened, where the players got nothing. But what was your reaction to AJ DeBunsta signing for what he did?
Well, first off, congratulations, dude. You just set yourself up forever. Just honestly, you know, and that's how it's going to be. Like, it could be a BYU, it could be a Miami of Ohio. Like, if they have donors, like, and every university, I don't care how big or how elite it was, every university has guys who have made a ton of money, you know? And so if you're able to get it, like you said, and you can give it to them, man, it doesn't matter if it's Kentucky or if it's Louisiana Tech. Like, if you're going to give a kid $7 million to go to Louisiana Tech, I'm going. Mm-hmm. Just to be honest, and you talk about the kid, AJ, how do you say his last, DeBunsta?
Yeah.
He's unbelievable. I mean, he's a mix of, like, I would say, we'll go back to like a T-Mac type feel. He has a little bit of KD in his game. He's super athletic. By far the number one person in the class. I mean, BYU has got a gem. He's an NBA player, no doubt. He's only going to do 1 year anyway. Wherever he goes, he's going to do 1 year. So you got to keep this in mind for BYU. They're spending that $5 to $7 million for 1 year in hopes that, you know, he could – you know, take him to a national championship. Now, will he do that? I don't think he'll do that. It depends on who else they bring in. And nowadays, you know, a guy like that signing, he's going to bring a lot of attention. And he's going to bring in better players as well. But what it is going to do for BYU is help their school overall. It's going to help their enrollment. It's going to help their apparel sales. It's going to help their ticket sales. It's going to help the other sports go into it. Look at all the attention it's bringing to them right now. I mean, it's just because of this one kid, but BYU is trending right now. You know, he was on First Take. The kid's in high school. He's talking to Stephen A. Smith and Shannon Sharpe on First Take about his commitment to BYU. You know, I think the other schools were like Kentucky or North Carolina. And people in the back of their mind, they see that list, and then they see BYU. They're like, what the heck? What is that school doing in there? Well,
of course, I thought that too. But the thing about it is the way that it was before was the person that was coming out of high school with that amount of hype and that amount of hoopla, it was the same attention. It was still the same. I mean, referring back to the Fab Five again, when they all went to Michigan, the amount of that the revenue went up, you know, it was on TV a lot more because they talked about it all in the book. You know what I mean? Their merchandise, everything like that all went up. They just didn't see any of it. So I think that's the main difference. And that's the difference that people are uncomfortable with now that the players are seeing. So now they're looking at numbers. They're looking at, you know what I mean? Wait a minute. Now this player has not, you know, he's earning this. Now that's the topic of a conversation. Now this person missed some free throws. And we saw that with Syracuse game. Look, they're missing free throws. This person is earning X amount. Then why should they be missing those free throws? So the conversation becomes different. You know what I mean? But it's not as much as, okay, this team has, you know, sold this amount of merchandise and we pay for this, so why aren't they having a better product? It's not on the team, it's on the player. And yeah, I think that's a shift now once you're putting in the dollar amount with NIL, then now the way that the fans view the actual athletes has become different. Would you agree with that?
Way different, because now you got so much more pressure. Now they can really criticize. I mean, they were already criticizing before, but like you said, the kid misses a shot to win the game, or he doesn't have a game or a few games that they expected. Oh man, you're getting paid $5 million for what? You know, what do you? I mean, you even see it at Syracuse. These guys are getting paid, you know, and you know, we talked about, you know, people talking about that already and criticizing. If you think they were criticizing before, it's going to be 100 times more, because now they're getting paid not only more than the fans, the average fan, way more than the average fan. They're getting paid more than their head coach. They're getting paid more than their assistants. They're probably, I mean, this kid AJ is probably going to be one of the highest paid people at the university. I mean, or within the city. You know what I mean? So the criticism is going to come because. Not only because he doesn't do well, and I think he'll do well, but because people are jealous and people are upset that a young kid can come in here and get paid that much money, you know, and that's what it comes down to. A lot of times people aren't secure enough in themselves to support something like that. And I'm not saying everyone. I'm just saying most of America. You know, when you see somebody coming in that young, getting paid that amount of money, that makes the average person insecure, because now they're like upset because they've been busting their butt, you know, their whole life, you know, working a regular job, making whatever, you know. But at the end of the day, that's what your journey is. You know what I mean? This kid is, you don't know what this kid has put in to get to this level. You know, I know for myself, like, I was sacrificing a lot growing up, like just to play basketball and just to get to that level. That kid was doing the same thing. You know, he was waking up early mornings. He was missing like extracurricular activities. He, you know, hanging out with his friends. Those are the, you when you commit to a sport, whatever it is, basketball, football, baseball, you're going to sacrifice a lot of your childhood. And that's just, I mean, that's just what it is. And I think a lot of people, they're not seeing that side of it at all. You know, they don't see the sacrifices made. They're only seeing, oh, this kid's getting $5 million. And it makes them feel uncomfortable. And in return, they're going to criticize.
And that's 100% correct. And I've experienced that myself personally at a high school level and a college level. I remember being in high school, being in English class. The teacher's name was Miss Enix. And she was saying that why the basketball team gets, you know, X, Y, and Z, and the speech and debate team doesn't. Now, I was on the speech and debate team and the basketball team in high school. And I said, and I explained to her, I was like, well, you understand that we have a Nike contract. Like we get these bags and these, you know, these warm-ups and all this stuff like that, and these shoes, because there's a contract that we have, that because we produce money and what we're making, and we have ticket sales. So every time we have a game, and I broke all that down. So we're going back and forth in the middle of class. And I was like, nobody is paying us to do speech and debate. Nobody's paying to watch us do speech and debate. That's, it's just economics. And the jealousy that you talked about is like, okay, why do you get this? And you know it in college. They're like, oh, why is a basketball team getting this? I was like, do you know how much the basketball team is making for the university? Every single time in the Carrier Dome, like when it is packed and you have a game, even if it's not a big game, all of the money that is made from the basketball team, but it's that thought that they don't deserve this. And that's the part where now, I know we have to go to a break, but now where you're having on Front Street kind of, you know, projected out what players are making in college. And now it's just becoming worse if they don't deserve that, or worse if they don't have a great game, or worse if they lose. You know what I mean? Or it's just, and absolutely, social media could be an evil place as it is, but yeah. I definitely have seen that vitriol go up as, you know, NIL has kind of entered into the conversation. But let's take a quick break and come back. And I want to ask you about this Caitlin Clark Time Magazine interview, because it created quite a stir, I'll say it that way. But let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of The Collision, where sports and politics collide.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and make you want me.
Now that I escape, sleep, walk, awake. Yeah. Those who correlate know the world ain't cake. Jail bars ain't golden gates. Those who fake, they break. When they meet their 400-pound mate, if I could rule the world, everyone would have a gun in the ghetto, of course. When get the up and on their horse. Kick around, drinking moonshine. I pour a sip on the concrete for the deceased, but no, don't weep. Why Clef's in a state of sleep, thinking about the robbery that I did last week. Money in the bag, banker look like a drag. I want to play with pelicans from here to Baghdad. Gun blast, think fast, I think I'm hit.
Classic Fugees, you know, let me just throw in there. Me and my daughter, baby Sierra, she loves Wyclef, loves the Fugees. We've been listening to them forever. And it's been two times we were supposed to go to their concert and they canceled. Two times we was all hyped and ready to go, and it was Lauryn Hill's fault that they canceled. But I just wanted to throw that out there. Wasn't very happy about that. But we're back on The Collision, where sports and politics collide. And we're here with Eric Diebendorf. And I want to ask you this. You know, it's just interesting, the Caitlin Clark issue and the topic. You know, I thought that the article that was in the Time magazine was a great article. You know, I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed watching her as a player. But there's a certain element of her fan base that are there for the wrong reasons. I'll say it like that. And this is the statement that she made that really made all of their feathers completely ruffled. They're talking about canceling her, no longer supporting her. Now they, and I was like, wow, all of that? But here, this is the statement she made. This is a part of the interview. She said, I want to say I've earned every single thing, but as a white person, there is privilege. A lot of those players in the league that have been really good have been black players. This league has kind of been built on them. The more we can appreciate that, highlight that, talk about that, and then continue to have brands and companies invest in those players that have made this league incredible, I think is very important. I have to continue to try to change that. The more we can elevate black women, that's going to be a beautiful thing. Now, I didn't really think that was that controversial of a statement myself. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. That, you know what I mean? That she said that. She recognized kind of like a little bit what Paige said a while ago. And I've heard Sue Bird say those kind of things. You know, other players have said that. But the reaction from the right, oh my gosh, they acted like she just said the worst thing possible to offend them. What were you surprised by the reaction? What was your thoughts about this, Ed?
So first off, I think Caitlin Clark she's handled it, everything like tremendously. Honestly, she's an unbelievable basketball player. And mm-hmm. I believe she has like everything that she, you know, from a basketball standpoint, she has earned. I mean, she's an amazing player. She's in her first year in the league. She's one of the best players in the league. You know, I took a team, Indiana Fever, to where they weren't good. And, you know, where did they go in the playoffs? Like maybe a series away from the finals, I believe, or maybe they lost in the first round. I don't know what it was, but
she had a good year.
Yeah, they had a good year. She's an unbelievable talent. For her to say that, I think it's great because, first off, we know how media is going to be with race. It's divisive. Like they want to make it divisive so they could have these arguments and have these topics and sway it one way or another. I just like how when she's talking about uplifting each other, you know, from basketball, football, it's dominated by it's African American sport, really. Like, let's just be honest. Like, you're not going to see a lot of great white players. Like you do, but it's few and far between. You talk Cooper Flagg coming up, but the league is made up of African American, right? So you want to support everybody, but in a league that's dominated by African American, you want to be able to obviously support them, right? And I think she's done a great job of trying not to make it divisive. Like the media wants to make it divisive. And at it, for me growing up, for white privilege for me in the sport of basketball, I can't say I've experienced it, right? Mm-hmm. I've never, because I was one of the only white guys growing up ever playing, you know, it wasn't for me. I don't know, for basketball, it's like I wasn't getting more calls because I was white, or, you know, I wasn't getting picked on a team. Same thing like Caitlin Clark said, I know that I earned it. I know I bust my butt, you know, throughout my whole career to be able to be on that court, white, black, brown, purple, whatever it is. One thing that I know that the media, and we live in a America where, man, it's so many issues with race. Obviously it's with the government, whatever. Yes. White privilege definitely exists. I believe more so outside of sport. From my experience, I haven't experienced it in sport with me. I'm talking about for me. Have I seen it? Yeah, absolutely. I've seen it. I think when a player like Caitlin Clark comes around, or a player like Larry Bird, or, you know, somebody, Cooper Flagg coming up, I think the media, which is mostly a white media, they grasp onto this to a Caitlin Clark, and they want to make it, this is the one, you know, in a sport that is dominated by African American, they want to get their shine on now. Caitlin Clark, she's the one, you know, she could do whatever she wants, you know, she can't do anything wrong. And that's where they bring in these, you know, rabid fans who are, you know, in so many words, racist, you know, because there's both sides. There's sides where you got she's the great white hope. Why do we even have to get into it? She's a great player, black, white, or brown. She's an unbelievable player, you know, but I think the media, when they see this type of player and she's white, they want to hold on to that, and they want to make it even more than it's really supposed to be. Because basketball, football is dominated by African American, so that in my mind, they're trying to like put her on a pedestal where she cannot be touched, because they don't get a lot of these white players coming around like that. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think the way that I would phrase it is they weaponized her. That's how I would phrase
it. Yeah,
weaponized her to be like the symbol of whether it's reverse racism or white victimhood or all the different things that you saw kind of interwoven into the politics. They brought Caitlin Clark into that. Now, I will give her props for saying, I think she maybe said it two or three times. She didn't get specific with it, but she said in different interviews, I don't want to be used for anybody's symbol for their agenda. You know what I mean? I just want to play basketball. Right. And the problem is, though, that, you know, no matter how much she says that, those are the people that are there for the wrong reasons, and they are going to weaponize her, and they did. And so I think that's a little bit of the reason that you saw so many people upset, because now it's like she's ruining it for them for what they wanted to try to use her for. And she's like, no, I'm not going to let you do that. I'm not going to let you say that the players are targeting me because I'm white. No, that's not what's happening. You know what I mean? I'm not going to let you say that, you know, a player, you know, flagrantly fouled me because I'm white. And she continues, and she said it in this interview, and she said it before. No, that is not what happened. She made a good play. You know, she poked me in the eye. She didn't try to stab me in the eye with her fingers purposely. And that's the way the media created it in order to really pump this racial, you know what I mean, division through and use Caitlin Clark as the catalyst for that. And that's I haven't seen it like this to this level. And that's in the event of social media. Like I could imagine how it was with Magic and Bird back in the day, but they didn't have social media. So, you know what I mean? Right. It could have been a little bit different, but here, ever since they played in college with Angel Reese, it was like the whole purpose of the game was divided by racial lines. And, you know, Angel Reese was casted as the bad guys, and they were the, you know what I mean? And she was looked at, you know, Caitlin Clark was like the, you know, I almost want to say the pedestal, you know, and if she got fouled, oh, look, they're targeting her. It's terrible. Like the white damsel in distress. And you know what I mean? I saw that kind of weaponized language since college, and it really just got worse and worse. That's what I saw.
Yeah, and it's really ridiculous that they bring it into basketball, because that's, I mean, when you're competing, when you're playing basketball, again, I'm going to speak from my experience. So growing up, being one of the only white guys, I never felt like that. We're competing. Like, I was one of the guys who was talking trash out there just as much as anyone else, you know. Mm-hmm. And as I grew up in my college career, I was, you know, I guess I received a little bit of backlash to that. But that was just a product of, you know, how I grew up playing. It was the competitive spirit. It was the love for the game. It was the energy and the effort that you were given. But now let's even take it a step further, you know, black and white. But now you're talking about in the WNBA, women of color, but and then LGBT. So, all you know, and all of that is, I think, has to do with, you know, what's going on in the media. You know, it's black and white, but it's women based. And then it's, you know, a lot of these women in the WNBA are LGBT, you know, so it's all that combined. And you know, with the media and how the government is doing, it's just a lot of back and forth, you know, with the LGBT, you know, with the women, with the gender about, and, you know, we can go into other issues about what they do with their body and all those things. And I think it was just kind of brought into the one big cluster, you know, even though it wasn't really talked about, but with this Caitlin Clark issue, those are all topics that, yeah, I guess can be talked about with this. But when you're bringing it into basketball, it's sad, because basketball is something that, for me, I went to get away from that type of thing. You know, basketball is like, you know, when you're a part of a team, I don't care, you know, if you're black, white, whatever. It doesn't matter to me. We all are here to accomplish one common goal, you know, and that's win. And my best friends have been through sport. You know, still to this day, we talked about it. You know, I've been around the world and traveled the world and met people with different cultures, different races, different creeds. And I, in my head, I never had a problem with, you know, a person's race. And I believe, I don't think Caitlin Clark does either. And I don't think these women that are playing in the WNBA do. But I think the media chastise these women. I think they rile them up. I think they, in the post game, I think they ask questions to where, look, and let's just be honest, a lot of these women or men and women, they're not ready to answer a lot of these questions that are asked of them. Like, so like some of the answers that come out, they could seem like maybe not the right answer or not the right thing to say. But the people in the media should never put these players in this position to even, you know, ask these, you know, type of questions about, oh, do you think, you know, Caitlin Clark, she follows you. Do you think it's because she doesn't like you because you're white? Whatever it was, it may be. I'm not saying they ask that questions, but I just think a lot of these players are not in position or equipped right now to even answer these questions. So a lot of the time the answers just make it worse. And now they feed off these answers and they make it even worse with their questions or with their articles and, you know, in the newspapers about race. Because it's not about race if she's following you. Dude, this girl is competing at a high level. I don't care if you're what color you are. You're competing at a high level. you're going to get knocked down. You're going to get hit. You know, you're going to have, you know, heated confrontations, whatever it is. And it's sad that Angel Reese was painted at LSU to be the villain, because she talks trash, and so do everyone else on the court. They're talking trash too, but she is just more so highlighted. Like, the media was like, all right, boom, this is what we're going to paint her to be. This is what we're going to paint Caitlin Clark to be. I saw Caitlin Clark talk trash as well, you know, or not showboat, but, you know, celebrate when, you know, she makes a shot or whatever it is. And the media is going to turn it and spin that into what they want it to be. And then when Angel Reese does it, they're going to turn it and spin it, you know, into what they want it to be about her. So
I remember I tweeted that watching it. I was like, wait a minute. Angel Reese did the same thing that Caitlin Clark did before. And there was literally a commercial about it. With the hand in your face and everything like that. I saw a commercial promo about it, and then when Angel Reese did it, she was villainized. But the problem is the way that they weaponized specifically, you know, Caitlin Clark throughout this entire process. And it was, like you said, she handled it well, you know what I mean? And she pushed it back, but it's kind of bigger than her. You know what I mean? Like, when you was talking about how, you know, we've experienced different things, you know, of course, playing basketball, I've been introduced to people from different cultures. I remember Marius Janulis, Lithuania, you know what I mean, Elvir Ovechkina from Bosnia, and I'm listening to him, and we're talking about all, we would have never really interacted before without basketball, but they were teammates, you know what I mean? And it was special, and it was amazing, and it was a beautiful thing, and that's what basketball brings. However, there is a different element that I referenced before, who are there for the wrong reasons. And they're not, and this is something that Chuck Modiano always says, they're not there for Caitlin Clark's skill. They're there for her whiteness.
Yeah.
And that is the only reason why they're there. So if she was a black player doing exactly what she's doing, they would have no interest. And there is a portion of the fans who feel that way. Now, are there different elements of throughout the history of sports where if you have a player who is now thriving in an area where there's not many players that look like them, have the people who are the same culture as them, then identified with that player and cheered them on more? Of course. That's what we did with Serena when she was doing her thing. Tiger Woods. 100%. Yes. Yeah. You know, I remember being young watching Zena Garrison doing well, or Dominique Dawes on the mat. You know what I mean? Of course. But the difference here with Caitlin Clark is then they started demonizing everybody else and you know, discrediting everybody else. And Caitlin Clark is the only person that matters. And Caitlin Clark, that was kind of the difference. And I think that made a lot of people be like, well, hold up. You ain't going to just disrespect everybody in this entire league. But that's what was happening more and more. Did you see that as well?
Yeah. And again, that's going back to like, all right, you're not going to see a Caitlin Clark or a white player like her come around a lot. So like the media being what the white media, they're holding on, they're grasping on that. Oh, we're gonna take this and we're gonna blow it up. Like this is our savior, so to speak, for basketball. And you know, again, like she's an outstanding player. You heard Dawn Staley, you know, talk about her at the end. Like, thank you for elevating the women's game, and for Dawn Staley to say something like that. I mean, she's one of the all-time greats, the lead playing and coaching. Yeah, I think that the media was just. They just took it to a whole nother level. Yeah, I mean, there's been players, you know, black players that have came in the league, you know, going back to Cheryl Swoops, Cheryl Miller, Lisa Leslie, the first, you know, women to dunk a basketball in the game, I believe. I said Cheryl Miller, right? Nancy Lieberman. They weren't doing this with Nancy Lieberman, you know. I mean, so it's just like they pick and choose. You know, and obviously, and now in 2024, I mean, it's so the issues are so heightened. It's so much more tension going on, and this just adds to it. And I honestly feel bad for Caitlin Clark, but I also feel bad for the WNBA because now, like, when this is happening, you feel like you have to have a reaction to it, right? Because it's human nature to protect yourself, right? And to have a response to it, because you're not just going to let somebody walk all over you. Because I'm not going to let somebody in the paper you know, just say something that's false about me, I'm going to probably put out a statement and try to retract that to like, hey, this isn't the truth. So a lot of the times these responses, like I said, some of these players weren't equipped or didn't have the answers that maybe sounded the best. So they always have a rebuttal. The media always has a rebuttal back. But I know in their heart what they're trying to say, especially being a basketball player and having been, you know, in those positions and experienced it. I know where their heart is. There's no really racial tension. Are they going to feel some type of way, you know, when the media, you know, promotes her more so for Nike or, you know, gives her a McDonald's, whatever? Yeah, because they feel like maybe they could have had that opportunity and they weren't, you know, they weren't pushed or, you know, put towards those opportunities as much as she was, you know. So and I could understand that. But, you know, we even talk about Asia Wilson. I think, you know, she has a Nike shoe, I believe. So there are players, you know, in the WNBA besides Caitlin Clark who are, you know, who have big endorsements, but it's you just wouldn't hear about it as much as Caitlin Clark because the media is, you know, on that side is dominated, you know, by white people. So that's what they're promoting. And, you know, that's
I think the media has acted real irresponsible when it comes to the way that they've promoted Caitlin Clark, because when they're talking about a lot of the hate, and you hear the WNBA players talking about the hate that they received and the racist taunts and the racism and everything like that, so much so that sometimes in the Indian arena, you know, security had to be called, all this different stuff that happened, right? And then you look at the way that the media has kind of drummed that. I mean, unfortunately, and this is the tough part, racism in these past few years, racism has been profitable. Like, it sells. Like, it draws eyes. It draws social media posts. It draws clicks. It draws all those different things. And the way that they've been using it, it's propelled a whole different demographic that wasn't going to be interested at all in the WNBA to now be interested. To now support Caitlin Clark, to now you know, be able to have a rallying cry where they say, oh, they're treating her terribly, oh, they're targeting her, oh, the, you know, the white victimhood, oh, we need to protect her from these big black players who are trying to harm her, like all of those type of things. And the media has been the ones that have been drumming that up, and I think it's very intentionally done. And that's why I say a lot of media people, I think they're largely responsible for a lot of the hate that was happening.
Well, the media is responsible for like 95% of the hate that's going on in the world, just to be honest. I mean, they're divisive. They divide people between black and white or whatever, you know, minority is out there. And at the end of the day, we're all human beings. You know, I grew up in a mixed town, you know, black, white, Mexican, Chinese. Did I see white privilege before? Absolutely, I saw it. I never entertained that. I never wanted to be a part of that because it didn't make me feel good as a person, and knowing that I would have the upper hand because of my skin color. And it's unfortunate that a lot of these people are coming out of the woodworks because they don't even have a clue about basketball. They probably never even watched Caitlin Clark play. But okay, the thing is, they have something to grasp onto now. To where, and a lot of it, I think, for these people who are ignorant and have ignorant words and say ignorant stuff on social media, it may have been how they were brought up. A big part of that was how they were brought up. And another part is like their experiences. They maybe they've experienced some racial tension before. And now they're, like we talked about earlier, they're holding on to that forever. And now any chance that they get where they could, you know, say something bad about, you know, African Americans or any other race and uplift this white lady, they're going to do it. And they're going to do they're going to do it in a different way.
100%. Couldn't agree with you more. But no, it's so crazy because an hour has gone by that quick. And it seems like you know what I mean? It's amazing how quickly the time goes by. But we have reached the end of our show. I appreciate you coming on, E. It was a great discussion. And yeah, much respect to you, you know, for everything that you're doing, everything you're doing in the community with your foundation and everything like that. Give the people your information one more time before we go. So just make sure they know how to contact you, get in touch with you, with your foundation.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on, E. So you can contact me at ed23hoops, ed23hoops.com, and then at ed23foundation ed23foundation.org. There's a donate tab to help us out with all our events that we do in the community of Syracuse, helping kids and helping everybody. And Ed, I appreciate you having me on. It was a blast, man.
That's what's up, man. Appreciate it. All right. Thanks a lot for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with more of The Collision, where sports and politics collide. Peace. On that blacktop, where dope heads could put the hoop game on pause to get the crack rock. We all thought we had the best handle. Crossover from the game to the game, dirty rotten scoundrels. Enticed by the serpent's tease, I bit the apple with an appetite worse than Eve's. I look at life full circle. Without them dark days, I never would have recognized the light. I had to hop hurdles. Thank the Lord for a good foundation. I'm running with the spirit now, and I'm crown chasing.
Greetings. This is Brother Jamil, host of Yardbird Suites. During this season of lights, we ask that you remember WPFW and the sustenance we provide to the community. You can give the gift of WPFW from December 15th through December 31st during our year-end membership campaign. It is indeed your generosity that has allowed WPFW to provide news, music, and information to the people since 1977. Donations can be made anytime at wpfw.org or by calling 800-222-9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year.
On Saturday, December 14th, from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m., WPFW and the King Solomon Grand Lodge host a winter coat and clothing drive. Donations of lightly used winter coats, hats, gloves, socks, and more can be dropped off at 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast. This is a one-day collection drive with distribution to those in need to occur on New Year's Day, beginning at 10 a.m. from the lodge. Additional information can be found online at wpfwfm.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3843. WPFW, our organizational partners and dedicated listeners, continue to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
During our upcoming end-of-year pledge drive from December 15th through the 21st, WPFW offers you the gift of knowledge as we dedicate the week to Brothers of Culture and Resistance, Bill Lucy, Quincy Jones, and Amiri Baraka. On Monday, December 16th, we commemorate Bill Lucy and the Black Workers Movement. Wednesday, December 18th, it's From the Pen of Q, a Quincy Jones retrospective. We close with Baraka at 90 on Thursday, December 19th. Detailed schedule at WPFWFM.org. You can give the gift of knowledge anytime by texting WPFWFM to 801-801. Helping us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. If you're already a cherished member of the WPFW Jazz and Justice Circle and your contributions this year have not reached $1,000, your membership will expire on New Year's Eve. To renew your membership or become a new member of the Jazz and Justice Circle through the end of 25, donations can be made during our year-end fund drive from December 15th through the 21st. Anytime before December 31st, Jazz and Justice Circle donations can be made several ways. By calling 202-588-9739 during the pledge drive. By visiting wpfwfm.org and clicking on the big red Donate Now button. Via Cash App at $WPFWFM or via text by simply texting WPFWFM to 80181 and following the clear and easy prompts.
On Monday, December 16th at 9 a.m., Uhuru Movement founder, Chairman Amala Ushatela, known to some as Joseph Waller, along with two leaders of the movement's White Solidarity and Reparations component, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, will walk into the federal courthouse in Tampa to be sentenced for the crime of speaking out for reparations, justice, and peace. In September, they were found not guilty of acting as Russian agents, but guilty of conspiring to act as Russian agents. Called a baseless and contradictory ruling, they are appealing the conviction. The Black community and all who believe in justice are invited to attend the hearing in Tampa on December 16th.